Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yaki in Washington. Ahead, our reporter on the Turkish-Syrian border speaks about a surge in fighting from ISIS.
We're seeing a very, very confused picture.
We'll look at what might be next in the embattled nation of Yemen. We meet an Italian immigrant to the U.S. who loves to share his cuisine and get a little black magic from our music department. Coming up right here on The Voice of America. Islamic State fighters have launched two major attacks in northern Syria, a French offensive on the Kurdish-held border city of Kobani and a push into government-held areas in the mostly Kurdish town of Hasaka. On the line with us from the Turkish-Syrian border is correspondent Jamie Detmer. Jamie, tell us what's going on. What have you heard today?
Well, today there was a surprise attack upon Kobani. It looks like IS managed to infiltrate parts of Kobani, which had been free, obviously, of Islamic extremists since the siege they had on the town was lifted about January. It seems that they entered both from the west and the east. They're not trying to retake the city. What they seem to be doing is to try to distract from an attack on their capital, so-called capital of the Caliphate, Raqqa. They were dressed, many of them, in YPG uniforms and the uniforms of the Kurdish fighters. They seemed to come from both sides, as I said, from west and the east, and they did a typical tactic of starting their attack with car bombs. One car bomb, in fact, and one motorbike bomb, which blew up in the early hours of the morning. We know that there are dozens of dead. We know at least 40 wounded have been transferred to hospitals in Turkey. Most of those are civilians and some Kurdish fighters.
What about a response?
Well, at the moment, I think the Kurds are really shocked that they managed to infiltrate the town. They seem to have cleared them now. The last report I heard was that some Islamic extremists were still holed up in one building in a house. As I said, this doesn't seem to be a full-scale offensive again on Kobani. What most Kurdish fighters and rebel commanders, Syrian rebel commanders, believe is that this is an attempt to divert attention away from Raqqa. As you know, earlier this month, about June the 15th, a very important border town that the Islamic State controlled, Tel Abyad, fell mainly to Kurdish fighters. They have pushed down further south and are now only about 31 miles, 50 kilometers or so, from Raqqa. We also know that there have been major reinforcements of Raqqa by Islamic extremists. People have been told who live in the town to stockpile food and fuel. So we think that this is more of a distractive move than anything else.
What is the feeling there along the border?
Nervous and very confusing for people. What we're seeing in the last few months is all sides, whether it's the Syrian government forces or whether it's the Kurds or whether it's the Syrian rebels or whether it's the Islamic State, having difficulty in maintaining control of their own territories and particularly of territory they've just captured. I think this is partly because all are suffering certain manpower shortages. They don't have enough troops to always retain the territory they've captured. So we get this seesawing that's going on in terms of the conflict, who's up and who's down. Only a couple of months ago, the Syrian rebels thought that they were on a good line after they managed to capture the city of Idlib and were talking about driving down towards Homs and then upon Damascus. But they got diverted by Islamic State extremists who were very, very mobile in terms of their forces, who started to attack them further northeast towards areas that they control near the border, which completely diverted the attention, if you want, of these Syrian rebels around Idlib who had to go back northeast again. So we're seeing a very, very confused picture.
Well, you be safe there along that border, will you? And thanks for talking with us today.
Pleasure, Susan. Thank you.
My colleague Michael Lippin is here now with an update on what social media is saying about the situation in Kobani. Michael, welcome.
Yes, thanks, Susan. Well, as you might expect, Kobani is a big topic on Twitter today. The name of the Syrian Kurdish town has been tweeted 37,000 times in the last 24 hours. That's according to the Topsy Analytics website. I'd like to highlight one particular person tweeting about Kobani today, and that is Washington-based reporter Zaid Benjamin, who works for VOA's sister network Radio Sawa. His handle is @ZaidBenjamin, all one word, and he's been getting attention on Twitter for a series of posts of images from Kobani. He's tweeted a couple of photos showing Kurdish civilians caught up and wounded in the Islamic State attacks on Kobani. Zaid also posted a video of one of the Islamic State car bombs that exploded inside Kobani, and this one's interesting because it happened right along the border with Turkey. Now, Kobani is a border town, and the video appears to have been filmed by a security camera on the Turkish side. The vehicle used in the attack seems to be driving right along the border road before it blows up. Another tweet from Zaid quotes Kurdish activists as accusing Turkey of allowing Islamic State militants to attack Kobani from the border crossing.
Oh, there's been some controversy about Turkey's role in the latest fighting. What are people saying?
Well, there is controversy. That tweet from Zaid generated quite a bit of debate by Twitter users who are commenting on it. Some of them agreed with the Kurdish activists that Turkey appears likely to have been complicit in some way in allowing the Islamic State fighters to cross into Kobani from its territory. But other people disagreed with that view, pointing out that in the past year, Turkey actually allowed many Kurdish fighters to go into Kobani to help oust the IS militants earlier this year. Susan?
Thank you very much, Michael. Our listeners are tuned to VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
A new study by researchers at the UK's University of Exeter finds that today's racehorses are running faster than their ancestors. The new finding contradicts previous studies that indicated the speed of the racehorse has leveled off. The UK researchers say that those past studies used smaller and more selective samples and didn't include factors such as ground softness. The British researchers analyzed a large data set of racing records that gave a more detailed overview of thoroughbred performance from the mid-1800s until 2012. The data analysis shows that race-winning speeds have greatly improved since 1850 and that the biggest increases in speed were found in shorter distance races. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Geneva peace talks between Yemen's warring factions have failed to produce a ceasefire agreement or even a humanitarian truce suggested by UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. The UN envoy for Yemen says the country is one step from famine, with 31 million people needing humanitarian assistance compared to just 7 million 2 years ago. Ismail-willed Sheikh Ahmed told reporters after briefing the Security Council behind closed doors Wednesday that all parties to the conflict are responsible for the dire suffering of Yemen's people. Ahmed, who mediated talks between the parties in Geneva last week, said that despite the failure to reach any agreement, there is an emerging common ground. VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy spoke with some experts about what are the scenarios that Yemen is up to, and he joins me now. Hi, Mohammed.
Hi.
Hey. What are the first impressions that you get?
Well, so analysts argue that the failure of the Geneva talks reflects the fact that neither side is ready now to compromise after nearly 3 months of fierce fighting. For example, Professor Charles Schmitz of Towson University in Baltimore, Maryland, says the gap between the warring factions was too wide to even allow for more humanitarian relief.
One of the factors that's pushing politically all sides of this conflict is that there is a major humanitarian crisis brewing inside of Yemen.
According to the UN, 19 of Yemen's 22 provinces faced a food crisis or an emergency. The country previously imported the majority of its fuel for the population, most of it by sea. But Saudi-led alliance has maintained a blockade in a bid to cut off arms supplies to rebel forces or the Houthis.
So what kind of endgame or political settlement do experts expect in Yemen?
Well, former U.S. Ambassador to Yemen, Stephen Sesh, believes that the most difficult challenge right now is to define what kind of end game is feasible without knowing what the Houthis' goals really are.
Well, the Houthis have never really issued a clear manifesto or statement of purpose or intent or motivation. So while they have a lot of high-minded rhetoric about, you know, trying to end corruption and return Yemen to a reform path, nothing that they've done suggests that that's really what they have in mind.
Experts say Houthis' behavior demonstrates clearly that their movement is about Houthi power rather than a change in the style of politics in Yemen. They agree that Houthis' oppressive rule is certainly not an appealing alternative for Yemenis. That's why Paul Salem, Vice President of Policy and Research at the Middle Eastern Institute, believes that the only way out of the continued conflict in Yemen is for the Houthis and forces loyal to former President Ali Abdullah Saleh to realize that they cannot control the country and have their forces all over Yemen. On the other side, Salem said the Saudis should realize that Houthis are not going to surrender and have to have a say in Yemen, relative, of course, to their size in the population. Salem acknowledged that Yemeni President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi made so many promises to his people during his tenure under the Gulf Cooperation Council's backed transitional process, but delivered very little. That, he said, could reduce his chances to be the key figure in the future of Yemen, but nevertheless, he is still the legitimate president.
President Hadi should be restored as president within a political process, whether there's a transitional government or fresh process or elections to elect another president soon.
However, Professor Schmitz ruled out any possibility of reaching a political settlement in Yemen soon. He expects that reaching a negotiated political settlement in Yemen can take up to 2 years.
Well, thank you very much, Mohammed, for that.
Thank you.
Coming up on International Edition, some good Italian eats and a little black magic from Little Mix. It's time for this week's Immigrant Profile, where we meet an immigrant to the United States and learn about how he got to the U.S. and the challenges and rewards of making a new life here. Today, VOA New York correspondent Adam Phillips introduces us to master chef and restaurateur Vincenzo Pezzilli, who came to America in 1998 with a simple desire to share the sublime cuisine of his native Rome with New Yorkers, who are sure they've already tasted it all. Hi, Adam.
Hi, Susan.
Well, tell us a little bit about this fellow.
Well, I first met him as a customer at his cozy restaurant on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, where I live. Now, listen, I've been to Italy many times before as a tourist, and I know how delicious their food can be. But let me tell you, one taste of his food put me right back in the old country. But it was his passion for his work and his Italian heritage and his incredible drive that told me that he'd be a great immigrant for our listeners to meet. So last week, we sat down to talk at a table at his restaurant. First, he asked one of his waiters for a piping hot, bitter espresso coffee, and then he began to tell me about his lifelong love affair with Italian cooking and how it began when he was just a young boy, a mere bambino in Rome.
So I think I was fortunate because since I was a kid, I always wake up very early in the morning, and all the mothers and the grandmas preparing the meal. And that was, to me, fascinating, and I always loved food. I think it was a love since I was a kid. And I started like that. I learned how to do penne arrabbiata for the first time without burning the garlic or the entire kitchen. And that same year, my mother, for Christmas, she presented me a wok and a Chinese cookbook, and I started experimenting with that. Mama Loretta was my first teacher, and she was not an easy teacher. She was pushy and put me under pressure, and I got screamed many, many times. But they teach me something. Here's the espresso. There you go.
Have a sip.
I love the little shuttle espresso in the morning. It's something very special.
So you wanted to come to America, like, as an adult, what made you decide that this was a place you wanted to go? It's not easy just to pick up and go.
Well, it was kind of a pick up and go. I was coming out from three-star Michelin restaurant in France, and I wanted to do a United States experience. And I actually went straight to the West Coast. Everybody talked to me about San Francisco, and I thought San Francisco was the gastronomical capital of the United States, let's put it this way. And I had to tell you the truth. I was disappointed. However, on my way back, I stopped in New York, and friend of a friend of a friend, we ended up eating together, and I was offered a job. So it was actually a kind of a mistake to end up in New York. It was never in my intention. I always thought California, probably because I come from Italy, I like the weather and the girls. Instead, here I am now. I'm almost 17 years.
What is it for you? I mean, why would you stay?
I like the energy, the competition, a little bit of all those dramatic things. Somehow work well with the Italian drama, and we kind of like the struggle of life. I'm afraid that many times people have the tendency to come to New York or the tendency to think about the American dream as this easy ticket for success. You know, you have to work hard in order to achieve the American dream. You have to live your life like a company, have a mission statement, know who you are and know where you want to go. Never give up, no matter what comes against you. I went through a bankruptcy several years ago. I almost lost $1 million. And I went through stress of life that I would say many people would have killed themselves. But you need to keep up, you need to go on, and eventually you'll take care of things, and who knows, you might get lucky.
Your restaurant is extremely successful. I come in here and I see people having a good time. There's not a table to be had. How did you build this? I mean, what did you do?
My secret is love. When I cook or when I teach my guys, first of all, I told them never to put out anything they wouldn't eat themselves. That's the number one. I don't have a lot of money, so a lot of the build is being done by myself, and a lot of the investing is being done as money come in. It doesn't come easy. It comes with a lot of struggle, and sometimes people might look at you a little crazy, like the crazy artist.
This conversation has made me hungry, Adam. Thanks for giving us a seat at the table.
You're welcome, and thank you, or should I say grazie.
This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Met when they were competitors on Simon Cowell's The X Factor television show. Now, they're about to release their third album. David Byrd and Larry London tell us about the four girls in Little Mix.
You might have seen them on The X Factor. You might be familiar with some of their other works, but they've got a new song out called Black Magic. They're a girl group known as Little Mix, and Larry London joins us in the studio. Larry, Little Mix started out as not as a group, but as individuals competing on The X Factor.
You could call them the female One Direction. Same story for One Direction. Simon Cowell discovered a bunch of solo artists that didn't make the cut, put them into a group, and then bang, they became very successful. So that's the story behind Little Mix. They were once known as Rhythmix, but now they're Little Mix, and they're coming out with their third album.
Now, this song, Black Magic, I watched the video for this, and they kind of played up, you know, it's four nerdy girls in college, and then they discover this book of incantations or whatever. Suddenly, they become, like, super hot, sexy pop babes, you know, like, it's really kind of comical the way they transform, you know. But one thing I noticed in this, the music in this particular tune reminded me of a lot of pop songs. Whitney Houston's I Want to Dance with Somebody, Cyndi Lauper's Girls Just Want to Have Fun, even like Hold On by Wilson Phillips. Now I'm really going back in the
You're
day.
You're digging, Dave.
I'm digging deep. But, you know, it's just kind of like you're listening to the tune and all of a sudden these little things are going, wait a minute, my musical memory is pinging.
Right.
Is this formulaic, do you think? Or do you think it's just all pop songs kind of have several common elements to
Well, it's good that you asked that because it was an intentional effort on their part to try and recapture the 80s sound. That's what they were going for, the 80s sound. And so they were very successful, obviously, with the artists and the songs that you just mentioned. That's right on target.
Well, now, an interesting thing I found out about this group, too, is that they actually wrote the song that Britney Spears and Iggy Azalea have on the charts, which is Pretty Girls.
Pretty Girls. Not doing too well.
But it's not doing too well, but they wrote it.
Yes. And they're very talented songwriters. In fact, they wrote this song that's featured on their new album that it leaked. The song leaked. It was supposed to come out in May. Or actually, it was supposed to come out in July,
right?
But it somehow leaked on the internet in May. So now the record label is stuck with a situation, so they're putting it out now.
Mm-hmm. So anything we can look for from the future of these girls? I mean, you mentioned One Direction. In One Direction, some of the guys are going in different directions.
Right, right.
But these girls seem to be in it for the long haul, right?
And there's an ironic twist to this, because Perry Edwards from the band is engaged to Zayn Malik from One Direction.
Who left One Direction.
And she was the villain. The rumor why he left was that she was jealous and he wasn't spending enough time with her. And so then he left and they're together and they're happy and they're getting married. But, you know, there was a connection there between those two artists beyond just being on The X Factor.
All right. Well, that's VOA's Larry London. You know, you can always contact Larry on Twitter. That's at @VOA_music. If you want to hit us up here on International Edition, that's at @VOA_IE. You can find Larry doing border crossings by going on to our website. That's www.voanews.com. That's where you'll have all kinds of interesting folks to talk to, hear from, hear their music from. And just check it out.
Thanks for joining us today.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Speaking at a panel on the sidelines of the 29th session of the United Nations Human Rights Council in Geneva, U.S. Special Coordinator for Tibetan Issues, Sarah Sewell, called on members of the council to join the United States in encouraging the Chinese government to live up to its international obligations to respect Tibetans' distinct culture, identity, and fundamental human rights. Special Coordinator Sewell spoke of the barriers and challenges facing the Tibetan people. Citing the State Department's human rights report on Tibet, she noted that the Chinese government engaged in the severe repression of Tibet's religious, cultural, and linguistic heritage by, among other means, strictly curtailing the civil rights of China's ethnic Tibetan population, including the freedoms of speech, religion, association, assembly, and movement. In response to the international community's concern over the Chinese government's actions in Tibet, China has responded with additional tightening of its already strict controls on Tibetans' fundamental freedoms. Chinese authorities have also taken actions to denigrate the Dalai Lama, whose views, said Dr. Sewell, are widely reflected within Tibetan society, and who the U.S. believes can be a constructive partner for China in addressing continuing tensions in Tibetan areas. The United States has consistently urged the Chinese government to uphold its international commitments to protect human rights and fundamental freedoms, specifically by ending the harassment, detention, and other mistreatment of individuals who seek to peacefully practice their religion, express their views, or seek legal redress. The United States, Dr. Sewell said, calls on Chinese authorities to release Tibetan Buddhist teacher Tenzin Delek Rinpoche and other prisoners of conscience, and to allow Tibetan filmmaker Dundup Wangchen to be reunited with his family.
That was an editorial from the United States government. You're tuned to the Voice of America, broadcasting from the nation's capital, and that would be Washington.